Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and on this week's show, we are chatting with Atlassian's head of security, Daniel Jalak, all about some AWS security tools he's come up with. He'll also be previewing a new tool for generating AWS access key honey tokens at scale, which is really actually quite cool. That's coming up a little bit later. This week's show is brought to you by Vericode. Vericode's Director of Developer Engagement, Peter Chesner, will be along in this week's sponsor interview to have a yarn about some common misunderstandings that occur between security people and developers. And we'll look at misunderstandings in both directions. That is good stuff, and it's coming up later. But before all of that, it is time, of course, for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, people have been flipping out over reports that hackers are, quote, targeting nuclear facilities, according to the Department of Homeland Security and FBI in the United States.
Yeah, so they've issued this kind of report slash, you know, Amber Alert thing saying that a bunch of nuclear power facilities and companies and operators of nuclear nuclear plants have been targeted by, you know, presumably Russian hackers, seems to be the inference. But yeah, that's has caused a lot of coverage in the mainstream media of the issue. Although, you know, I guess, you know, for those of us who work in this industry, that, you know, the fact that those sorts of things are getting targeted is not even slightly, I guess, new or interesting or something. Surprising. But yeah, in combination with the, you know, the stories that have come out of Ukraine in the last couple of years, plus this kind of you know, step towards mutually assured destruction in the cyber realm, as we saw, I think we talked about, what, 2 or 3 or 4 weeks ago, about the Obama administration's response to you know, Russian intrusions into the American electoral process by, you know, kind of saying, well, let's go ahead and implant all of the Russian utilities and other critical infrastructure to kind of hold a you know, to hold some kind of leverage over them. The fact that, you know, they would then see an uptick in attacks or processes of breaking into, you know, people running nuclear facilities, sort of an uptick in that. I don't think that's a surprise. But yeah, whether this means anything different from the last, you know, 20 years, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, they've specifically called out, the New York Times has specifically called out Russia, which is why this is probably getting so much play. And I can understand why people feel a little bit twitchy about, you know, various Russian APT crews getting all up in their nuclear utilities. I mean, it makes you feel a bit funny in the pants, you'd think. I mean, given what we know now, do you know what I mean? Like, I know it's not new, but given the context, you know, given the backdrop, rather, it's easy to understand why people are having a little flip out over this.
Yeah, and I guess sort of the real question is deterrence in the style of, you know, Cold War mutual assured destruction, is that a thing in the cyber realm? And I think this is what we are on the crux of, and that's why people are worried, is because, well, maybe it isn't, right? Maybe it doesn't have that sort of stabilizing effect that we had in the Cold War. And yeah, I mean, clearly the Russians have been willing to use these kinds of things in the Ukraine. Why wouldn't they use them somewhere else? Although, on the other hand, all of the people in the nuclear industry in the US are very quick to point out that it's fine because they have air gaps protecting their nuclear equipment, and nobody knows how to jump air gaps in nuclear facilities. No one's ever done that.
At all, yeah. Now, this is fun, man. Fun story. It looks like Alphabay, one of the dark markets, has exit scammed. They've just disappeared. And, you know, there's some epic Reddit threads on this with, you know, various rumors and whatever. But, I mean, the one rumor that keeps coming back and back and back is that one of the senior administrators basically got doxxed and just decided to pull the plug and walk away, which, you know, I think the best thing to do is probably to walk away before you get doxxed. But this is the second best thing.
You do make a solid argument there that perhaps that would be not quite the right time. But yeah, it does seem that the Alphabay, which, you know, I gather was one of the biggest dark markets, sort of replaced the, you know, the Silk Road and some of the other underground sites on the dark web where you could buy such things as drugs and guns and whatever else. Yeah, they've disappeared. And it does seem like some of the bits of the blockchain that were used as escrow accounts, some of the Bitcoin addresses used as escrow accounts, have started to get cleaned out, which does make it look a little bit, you know, like an exit scam.
Let's get ready to tumble.
And I hope those guys know how to tumble well, because there's going to be a lot of pissed off people. And there are, as you alluded to on Reddit, there is a lot of people who are, you know, upset, concerned about losing all of their you know, fake darknet money from their criminal proceeds. But yeah, I hope those guys know what they're doing, because if they don't have their OPSEC tied, and if in fact they do get doxxed, this is only going to exacerbate the fact that those docs exist and whatever comes out of that. Because, yeah, there's some people presumably in those markets that actually you don't want to piss off in real life. And
yeah,
I'm pretty sure they just did.
Yeah, it's funny, right? Because like when they first went offline, which was about a week ago, I tweeted something about it. And then a friend of mine messaged me and said, nah, man, Alphabay didn't, you know, didn't exit. I'm like, oh, what makes you say that? Like, because if they did, I'm out half a Bitcoin, you know? I'm like, okay, your reasoning is sound. Fair enough. There's also a really interesting post on Reddit where a person claims to be the one who doxed this admin, you know, not publicly, but has doxed them, figured out their identity. And the way that they claim that they did it is that I think they'd done some work for the site and the admin paid them from a cold storage wallet. And he just tracked the address. And eventually some of it went straight to an exchange instead of a Tumblr. And I think they had a friend at the exchange or whatever and got their real life identity that way. So yeah, I mean, it's an OPSEC mistake that trivial that can bring you undone.
Well, yeah, of course, OPSEC is super hard, right? And you got to do it right all the time forever. And, you know, you run a high-profile enterprise, you hire people, you'd eventually you got to trust people. And then, you know, sometimes those people aren't worthy of your trust. That seems to be the case here. But
That's a delicate way of putting it. True. Meanwhile, in South Korea, this cryptocurrency exchange, Bithum, or is it Bithum? I got no idea how to pronounce that. But apparently they're compensating users following a minor security incident.
Yes, apparently they lost, what, up to 30,000 users worth of data and some coins and things. Some people are out quite a lot of money, and whether or not they will enjoy the fact that this particular Bitcoin exchange, unlike many others, has decided to make good some of the losses by paying them compensation up to $80 US, $86. So that's, you know, that's good for all you high roller Bitcoiners who've lost your money.
And look, staying with the dark market theme in this week's show, Bleeping Computer, which these days has a security reporter on staff, Catalin Kimpanu. I don't know how you pronounce that either. But apparently Catalin reports that a dark web hosting service got owned, whole bunch of data stolen. And, you know, we got a nice little list of the Onion addresses there. Were there any interesting sites among those that got popped?
There was some like underground auction / marketplace sites, and I assume the regular sorts of selections of things. But yeah, there didn't seem to be anything particularly high profile. Although I think the funny thing here is, of course, that this hosting company was offering, you know, essentially shared hosting from the 90s, and they got owned because someone uploaded like a PHP web shell through the FTP site and just got code exec. Like, I don't know what you expected from your underground dark web, you know, deep hosting service.
It wasn't it wasn't that easy. They had to try their Perl shell first, and that failed. Now, look, final story along these lines. The head of Mt. Gox, you know, the now defunct Mt. Gox, Mark Karpeles, he is facing up to 5 years in jail. This is all moving through the Japanese courts. Now he's had charges pressed against him. He's pled not guilty. He's saying, hey, I still don't know where those 850,000 bitcoins went. No idea.
To his lawyers, perhaps, to pay his legal bills. But yeah, it doesn't look like it's going to end well for him, which I guess is no surprise at all. But yeah, it's just taken a very, very long time to work its way through the Japanese legal system.
Well, I'm imagining that this is a pretty complicated prosecution brief. You know what I mean? Like, I can't imagine how you lay this out for a court and actually prove it. So we'll see how it ends, right? It might be one of those things that's sufficiently complicated that they can't prove any wrongdoing. So we'll just, you know, I'm sure we'll keep seeing some reporting on that over the next year or two or five. Now, this is an interesting one. A couple of Latvians have been arrested for running what amounts to a, you know, virus total service for people to test their malware on, you know, so that they don't have to give their malware to Google, right? Which some people actually still do, which is just bizarre, right? Like, do not even we saw, you remember we saw some espionage malware that had been, like, they'd tested it on VirusTotal. You're just thinking, what, you don't have a custom tool for that? But yeah, these two Latvians have been arrested for running a dodgy VirusTotal equivalent. I mean, this isn't the only service that does this, but it is interesting to see people arrested specifically for this.
Yeah, it seems like actually two or three of this type of service have disappeared over the last last 3 or 4 months. So it does seem like maybe there's been an attempt to go and crack down on this particular a part of the thing. But yeah, their service apparently was quite slick. They had like an API interface, so you could like programmatically have your malware checked during the build process. So you just kind of automate it, which, you know, that seems very, you know, agile and modern.
Yeah,
modern continuous integration approach, which is good to see. You know, keeping up with the latest development trends there. But yeah, they've been arrested and I guess going to face charges. One of them is a dual Russian citizen, and that apparently is complicating things somewhat. But their service disappeared earlier this year and looked like they are going to have a bad time as a result now.
Yeah, and it's the US doing the arresting in this case, so almost certainly going to have a bad time when you look at the conviction rates in federal cases in America. So see you around, guys, basically. Lorenzo over at Motherboard has written up a really interesting story and proving that things kind of panned out the way that I expected them to when Apple launched its bug bounty program for iPhone code, like to much fanfare. That was Black Hat like last year, right? And basically, by the looks of things, no one's submitting bugs. And to me, that makes total sense. It doesn't matter that you're offering $200,000 for a bug, right, to be submitted through this program. The thing that I think has done them in this case, is that these days creating those sort of bugs, I mean, the expertise that's required and the collaboration that's required, it's very different to typical bug bounty stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of what bug bounty endgame looks like. Like once you've done it for a long time and your product's really, you know, relatively robust and bugs are really hard and very expensive to find, this is what you, the situation that you end up in, where a bug bounty program is not really an effective mechanism to kind of get the complicated bugs out of the woodwork. And I think, you know, Lorenzo's done a really good job of talking to a few people who've been invited to go on the program and got a bunch of the kind of background information that Apple provided to people who were invited to participate. And there's a number of interesting kind of threads that came out of it. One of them is that to do effective Apple, you know, iOS bug research, you have to have a whole bunch of bugs already. Like you have to have a jailbreak to be able to get into the device to then go find more bugs. And you don't want to burn the tool that then lets you find more bugs. And so people are hoarding them, you know, for their own tooling purposes. And then, yeah, of course, the other thing is the commercial competition for those kind of bugs is, you know, much paying out, potentially much more money than Apple is offering. And I think the thing that I took away from this is that really Apple needs to, you know, whack a couple of zeros on the ends of those numbers and see how that changes the game. Because, I mean, if no one's submitted a bug in the year the program's been running, clearly they need to do something differently. And I would imagine that if a, you know, end-to-end working jailbreak was $20 million,
jeez, though, like,
no, I mean, okay,
you're well, right. That'd flush him out, though. You know what I mean? Like,
well, and the thing is, right? One, it would outcompete, you know, Zerodium and other people. But the second thing is, you point out that these bugs require collaboration. Right? This is not a one person enterprise anymore. And all of a sudden, if it's worth $20 million, the chances that the people you're working with are going to rat you out. Like it destroys the social aspects of finding those bugs. And I think for Apple's perspective, that would be a really good place to spend their money, right? If you make everyone distrustful of everybody else, you make recruiting so much harder, you add all these kind of extra impediments to sharing information because all of a sudden it's worth like real f*** you money. That would change everything. And from Apple's point of view, they got how many billions of dollars in the bank? What do they care? You know, they're going to pay out once maybe.
Yeah.
Why not, right? That seems to be like a smart play.
Well, I mean, let's just see if they twiddle the amounts, you know. But what's interesting too about the program is that they pay per like step in the chain. So they're not really just saying, oh, we'll pay you for end to end. We'll pay you for like, you know, something that allows access from a sandboxed process to user data outside of the sandbox. That's $25,000. But the thing is, right, like if you're doing that sort of research, you are working in a collaborative environment with a bunch of people who are working on little bits of the end-to-end chain. And that's just sort of how that research happens. So the idea that someone would just come up with that, you know, in their spare time or, you know, just by poking around, it just seems, I don't know. I'm just not convinced they're doing it right. It doesn't mean I don't think they should be doing it.
No, I mean, I agree. Like them having a bug bounty program, even if no one submits, kind of sends an important message about their willingness to engage, which is good, like regardless. But yeah, clearly it's not working in the way that a regular bug bounty program works. But then again, this isn't a regular bug bounty, right? I mean, it's different structure, different targets, or, you know, a couple of orders of magnitude more complexity and profile than anything else. So, you know, it's like, I guess we can't expect it to work exactly like like everything else. But yeah, I just think they should pay a whole bunch more money and see what happens. Not because I'm sitting on bugs.
Now, look, let's turn our attention to this Kaspersky mess. Bloomberg ran a story that strikes me as a bit of a beat up, to be honest, claiming Kaspersky has very close links to the FSB and that they were accompanying the FSB on raids and things like that, which, you know, to be honest, fits pretty well with what I know of Eugene Kaspersky in that he's geared the company very much towards trying to stamp out cybercrime in whatever way they can, much like Microsoft cooperates with the DOJ to try to shut down botnets and stuff. It seems like that sort of arrangement to me. But it's being turned into a thing, and we've just seen the news feeds light up with claim and counterclaim. I mean, Kaspersky now is offering its source code up to US authorities for inspection, stuff like that. I mean, what do you make of all of this, Adam?
Well, I mean, I guess it's always been a concern, you know, that national interests, you know, would get into the way of commercial arrangements when you're, you know, procuring software, be it Kaspersky in Russia, be it, you know, Checkpoint in Israel, be it Microsoft in the US.
Or Huawei from China. I mean, you know.
Huawei from China, right? I mean, there's always been this concern that the national interest, you know, would be a thing that might be leveraged, you know, and, you know, obviously Kaspersky have made a, you know, a good reputation for themselves on, you know, good quality research and good quality products and, you know, a fairly consistent you know, public face, at least on how they deal with, you know, the fact that they are Russians and the, you know, the things that may come with that, you know, and it does read like a bit of a beat up. But on the other hand, it's also one of those things that's really hard to prove a negative. I mean, how are they going to make any assertion that they're not cooperating? And I mean, as you pointed out, exactly, like there's, you know, cooperating with domestic law enforcement for that kind of thing is absolutely what you'd expect and what Microsoft do in the US. So yeah, it's just a really thorny situation. And then seeing them, what they were got thrown off the list of approved security vendors in the US, like just in the last few days, which, you know, sounds more political than
it does. It does. But you raised a really interesting question, and it's a question that I've written to Kaspersky. I've written to one of the people on their PR team and said, look, I'd like to get Eugene on the show to ask him specifically that question, which is, okay, it's all well and good for people to see your source code, but how can you provably, you know, how can you mess with your software so that it can't be fiddled with a rogue update? Now, I think a rogue update, which seems to be the concern, a rogue update dispatched to certain endpoints at the will of the Russian government seems a pretty shoddy way to get shells, right? Because it's noisy. People are going to notice.
Blunt instrument.
Exactly. And that will totally tank Kaspersky. And I don't think the Russian government would really want to do that to one of its most successful companies. That said, how can Kaspersky make changes to its software to minimize the chances of it being interfered with? And I think that's an interesting technical challenge, and one that other companies could learn from as well.
Yeah, I mean, coming up with an architecture for how you do updates and how you prove the integrity of the build process and having a repeatable build process, for example, like that's a thing that a lot of people have thought about, but actually doing is very hard. And sort of Kaspersky does have the, you know, the sort of security nous and expertise and research capability to come up with good answers to some of these questions, I'm sure. But yeah, it is. It's a, like, software supply chain is super complicated, and, you know, in the first place, you know, and defending against interference in that, you know, I'm thinking the MEDOC example in the Ukraine. I mean, from an outside influence, it's difficult. But when you're trying to defend against, you know, potentially your own employees operating in the national interest or as, you know, with dual allegiance to a, you know, intelligence agency or something, like, that is a really complicated challenge. And yeah, I would be interested to know what they think about how they can do that, you know, how they can come up with an approach that would actually be usable.
I'm also interested, PR people, if you are listening, because I think it's a really interesting issue, you know, and I think it's most of the coverage on this is only sort of scratching the surface. So let's see how we go there. Staying with Russia, and this isn't really a security story, but apparently all sorts of dissidents in Russia have been using Pornhub to distribute like subversive material. So now Russians need to like register. They need to access Pornhub via this like OAuth thing that's linked to their actual IRL identity, which is just wow.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, eh? They've enabled this kind of federated auth with VKontakte, and to have a VKontakte account, you have to have a valid Russian phone with a, you know, mobile phone with a SIM, and to get a valid SIM, you have to have a passport, and so they have a way of kind of tying your Pornhub account with your actual identity, which, yeah, I I don't know. I feel sorry for the bit of the Russian, you know, interior ministry or whatever that has to deal with, you know, processing those logs. But yeah, I don't know. What a mess.
Yeah, it's just, look, I mean, wow, what a sign of the times, right?
Yeah, I know. What can you say? You know, dissident political activism being carried out on porn sites because that's the, you know, most effective media to reach your audience with. I don't know.
And it's time for Data Breach Corner, Adam. Data Breach Corner. Sabre, owned pretty hard.
Yeah, the hospitality part of Sabre Corp that provides, you know, booking systems for planes and all sorts of things appears that they got really quite well owned some time ago. They run reservation systems for something like 32,000 hotels around the world. They had a bunch of card data stolen after a breach of their central reservation system. And to kind of make it worse, it turns out they were storing not only ClearText card data, but also the CVV values. And that's not a thing that the card brands are going to let them get away with without some really, really big fines, I'm sure. So yeah, someone is paying them a lot of money. Mandiant's in investigating the usual things about, you know, credit monitoring and all that kind of thing apply. I didn't see any mention of free credit monitoring, but maybe that's gone out of fashion now. But yeah, if you booked a hotel in the last couple of years, your credit card's probably due to be replaced. But then again, every other hotel chain's been, you know, every other hotel booking system appears to also be skimming cards. So, you know, you probably should have expected it.
Also, Trump hotels have been affected by this one too, because they apparently use Sabre's Synxis central reservation system. So way to go, Trump organization. now here's some news. Like, you know, Let's Encrypt have really disrupted the SSLosphere. Let's call it that, the world of SSL and TLS. You know, Let's Encrypt, of course, is the free CA that enables you to get free DV certificates for domains like www.paypal.com.attackerdomain.com. They will be now offering wildcard certificates in 2018. And I'm just thinking, why? Because, you know, the best defense that organizations had against rogue certificates being issued by Let's Encrypt was to monitor certificate transparency feeds for text that, you know, do a fuzzy search for text that might match their domain names. Now that they're issuing wildcard certs, you can't do that anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, attacker.com is going to be much easier for the operators of attacker.com. They won't have to worry about getting all of those pesky certs with all of those pesky things and going to give away their campaigns and the cert transparency logs. So, yes, they're definitely disrupting even more.
I just don't really see, when you've got an automated process already, why do you need to introduce a wildcard cert into the mix? Like, why would you do it? You know, like it just seems a bit silly. And yeah, look, I know most of this comes down to browser UI issues and whatever, but why would you do that?
I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. I'm not sure what their rationale is. Certainly, as someone who consumes their services, you know, for the purposes of running phishing campaigns and, you know, dodgy man in the middle shim sites and things, it sounds really convenient having a wildcard. So
an attacker, right? Just step outside of that mindset for a second. if you're trying to defend stuff and not own everything, why is this good? That's what I thought.
Pass? I'm not sure.
That's what I thought, right? Oh, here's a bit of good news. If you got owned by the original Petya ransomware as opposed to the not Petya ransomware, the decryption key has been released.
Yeah, the guy has showed up apparently and released the master keys, and then a couple of antivirus researchers, a guy from Kaspersky, I think, has put together a tool that will allow you to recover your data that was encrypted by the original Petya and GoldenEye, which is kind of one of the later variants of it. So that's nice, you know, I guess.
That is nice.
The guy did a nasty, horrible thing, and then now, you know, the four people who've still got their encrypted disk can get their data back. So that's good, right?
We got a couple of bits of new information on NotPetya. It turns out that MEDoc, this is the Ukrainian accounting software firm that, you know, seeded the malware outbreak in the first place. It turned out they got owned, their update servers were owned for quite a while before the attack, which makes it increasingly look like this was a pretty tightly planned operation.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the conclusion that you draw from this. It looked like the attacker had been in there a while, had a bunch of access, had been you know, seeding some of the groundwork for this for quite some time in advance, and it really contrasts very strongly with the, you know, super shoddy payment mechanism of the, you know, alleged ransomware. Yeah, it does. You know, it looks a lot like Russians. But yeah, it's I don't want more you're going to say than that. It kind of looks like
Russians. Meanwhile, the people behind NotPetya have apparently been in contact with the team at Vice Motherboard. They've had a bit of a chat. They're now saying, give us $250,000 in bitcoins, like 100 bitcoins, and we'll release the master key that decrypts everything. Unfortunately, that decryption key only applies to files apparently under 1 meg in size, right? So of limited use.
Yeah, I thought this was an interesting development, though. I didn't think that we would necessarily see this, like the people behind it kind of showing up, A, clearing out the Bitcoin wallet, because that just gives people something to look at, and B, actually, yeah, talking to the media, and then they actually decrypted a file for Motherboard to kind of prove that they possessed the crypto keys and they weren't just trolling them. I mean, I think probably they are still just trolling them, but they did actually successfully decrypt the file, and there are some technical limitations because of the rubbish crypto process. You said, you know, files over 1 meg. There's also some issues with whether or not the file system was modified post-crypto in that kind of detail. But yeah, the fact that they actually showed up and decrypted, like, I'm not sure what that adds to the story and why they would do that. I mean, other than just, look, you know, muddying the waters and confusion, right?
This one just feels funny and it feels different, right? Like, I think there's a ways to go in learning more about the NotPetya outbreak, because I just get a funny vibe from the whole thing, right? So, and this just adds, you know what I mean?
Yes, you know, absolutely. It doesn't really fit together into a proper narrative yet. And yeah, that just implies that we just don't know the full story, or, you know, all the other bits of the that we need to figure out to understand it.
Yeah. Meanwhile, there is this bug that's going to be presented at Black Hat, affecting Broadcom Wi-Fi chips that are embedded in Android and iOS devices. Someone's reversed an Android patch, even though, you know, the details aren't public yet, but someone's reversed an Android patch, and they reckon it's a heap overflow involving Broadcom BCM43XX, that family of Wi-Fi chips. But you know, these sort of bugs are pretty serious, and they affect an awful lot of devices.
Yeah, this bug, if it is as described, will be a real doozy, I think. Hey? It sounds like, according to the guy who reversed it, it's a heap overflow processing some of the like quality of service packets. So you send it a 802.11 IL that's kind of longer than it's meant to be, which has been the source of almost every wireless over-the-air bug, that parsing of the variable length IL fields. But yeah, that happening in the WME quality of service listening bit of the Broadcom SOC that processes the wireless, I guess the vector would be you're on a wireless network and then someone sends you a frame and gets code exec up in your kernel or up in the chip and from there owns your device. Like, that's pretty bad, and you would be able to do that on, you know, any wireless network. You just have to convince the target to join a wireless network, which is not exactly going to be complicated. So yeah, that, and across such a range of devices, those chips are super common. I don't know what percentage of Apple devices use that particular one, but I mean, that's a it could be really, really bad.
Yeah, you could have a lot of fun at somewhere like, say, Black Hat with with a bug like that, right?
So yeah, maybe turn off your wireless at Black Hat. That's
Wi-Fi.
Good advice anyway, but yes, just don't.
Just don't. OpenBSD is doing some funky stuff with its kernel, so that you get a unique kernel each reboot. But this is not ASLR, but it sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, no, it's quite a cool idea. They at a kernel install or upgrade time or reboot time, they'll actually relink the kernel binary. So they'll have the linker reassemble the binary with the different, you know, bits of the code kind of rearranged in the actual binary image, so that they're in a different order and a different relative address to each other. This is different from ASLR, where the kernel is just like the same kernel image is loaded into different locations in memory. In this case, the relative difference between bits of it is also changing, which kind of makes figuring out where you are through an info leak even more complicated. So yeah, seems like a good idea to me. Why not?
Now, look, that's pretty much it for the week's news. But before we go, I forgot to mention last week a big story that broke in the sort of InfoSec Twitter sphere is that Matt Tate, otherwise known as Pwn All The Things, has actually found himself squarely in the middle of this Trump-Russia stuff. I mean, the reason that I started following Matt and the reason I had him on the show some months ago is because he did some really interesting analysis around the DNC hacks. And it turns out I wasn't the only one to notice that his research was pretty interesting. Some somewhat shadowy GOP operatives also noticed.
Yeah, apparently he was talking to some members of the GOP and Trump campaign during the lead up to the last election, and they were interested in A, getting his take on the DNC, and B, getting his opinion on legitimacy of emails relating to Hillary Clinton that they were being offered by, you know, allegedly Russians by some mechanism. So yeah, he's really found himself right in the middle of it, and then yep. has written up on Lawfare his experiences of dealing with the Trump campaign and, you know, what they were looking for and what they were expecting at the time. And that's a, yeah, I'm glad I'm not him, frankly.
Yeah,
there's not a place
yeah.
I'd like to be.
I mean, the first thing I did, obviously, was get in touch with him and say, man, you know, this is your inevitable and entirely predictable interview request. And he said, can't, lawyers, you know, so he's not going to be talking about it, but I'd imagine we'll be seeing him on C-SPAN being sort of whisked into the building wearing, you know, double thickness bulletproof jackets, like... any day now. So, yeah. So Matt, good luck to you.
Good luck.
And you know, there's a link to his Lawfare write up in this week's show notes. But Adam, that is it for the week's news. Thanks heaps for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, you're very welcome, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Daniel Jalak, who is the head of security at Atlassian. Daniel has a background in security consulting. He used to work for BAE StratSec. He's also thrown together some cool projects. One of them was shouldichangemypassword.com, which I guess was the predecessor to Have I Been Pwned. He sold that one off years ago and then went and worked on a gaming startup for a while before returning to the InfoSec industry and discipline at Atlassian. These days, as I mentioned, he is the head of InfoSec over there. And as you'll hear, he has to deal with an awful lot of cloud stuff, in particular Amazon Web Services. Last year, Daggers did the rounds with a conference talk about some of his AWS tricks. He's written a bunch of tools for doing unnatural things to Amazon Web Service environments. And he's about to release something new, an automated honey token generator and monitoring system for AWS access tokens. He worked on that one with his colleague Daniel Burke, and it'll be released sometime in the next month or so. It sounds really quite good, actually. So I spoke to him about that. It's free and open source as well, I should mention that. So I spoke to him about that new tool, but I also got him to recap his work from last year. In essence, AWS is a lot more complicated than just being a place to put virtual servers in, he says. Here he is.
Building stuff in AWS is simple, right? Like, you spin up a virtual machine, it's a piece of cake. You spin up a three-tier web app, it's trivial, right? Like, you just do it. You press the buttons and it happens. But doing the security is deceptively hard, especially once you've already built this big architecture. Doing it in retrospectively is even harder. So things like cleaning up dangling domains is impossible, right? Like, everyone has those issues. And if you try and do it right, you have to read so much doco that no one person can read it. For example, there's these little important boxes in the AWS doco, like the title is important. And you should read all of those because that's how you find all the good juicy information on how to hack stuff. But I went through and tried to grep for all those important search boxes on the doco, and there was over 1,200 of them. So just to know all the important bits of information, you have to read 1,200 boxes.
Yeah, that's a bit.
exactly.
And what the hell is a dangling domain?
So it's a domain that you've set up to do something. Maybe it points to a third-party service like a support service or something like that. And then you decide you don't want to use it anymore. And so you just take that service away. But the domain and the pointer still remains. And so someone can come along and claim that pointer. An S3 bucket, for example, is a common occurrence of that. And so people will register the S3 bucket that your domain is pointing to and then host malicious content there, like a phishing website, for whatever targeted stuff against your company. So if it was called support.acme.com, then you would put a phishing website for a support function.
So there's you used to have some stuff in an S3 bucket from that domain. You've abandoned that S3 bucket. Somebody else can come and grab it, throw some stuff in it, and bang, they've got a website on your domain.
Exactly. And S3 buckets are a global domain space. So like anyone can register any S3 bucket and then it's theirs forever.
Happy days. So that's one issue. Where I get a bit confused when we start talking about like AWS security is because we're dealing with just virtualized, you know, normal operating systems. How is it any different to locking down a normal box? Is it just the scale and the architecture because there's so many boxes all of a sudden?
So that's the simplest form of AWS service is a virtual machine. But I just quickly before this interview, I had a look, and there's over 90 services that Amazon provides. So everything from databases, to queues, to virtualized video transcoding, like anything you could ever want but is available in AWS. And when you try and lump all of these things together, it becomes really complex really quickly. So it's not just about locking down the operating system of one virtual machine. It's everything that you're potentially doing in AWS.
So why don't you walk us through some common pitfalls?
So there's a global API that you use to do anything in AWS, whether it's spin up an instance or whatever else. And people often use their root keys to play with these services, to actually use them. And then those root keys get compromised. And then it's not just about the system that someone's compromised. It's about everything else that they can do in the account. One that I like to show at conferences is not everything is logged globally. So some things are logged in a specific region. So logging into the web console is logged in the specific region to which you logged into. But an attacker can go log into another region and then go do all play with all of your stuff in your AWS account. And if you're not logging globally, you won't ever see that action happening.
So you got some blind spots, I guess, is what you're getting at there.
Yeah, exactly. And logging is really problematic because not everything is turned on by default. So you've got to actively go and turn everything on to get the visibility that you need. And typically, you only find out you need the visibility after there's been an incident.
Yeah, and you go, where are my logs? Oh, I don't have any because I'm a dumbass.
Something like that.
Well, maybe not quite that harsh, but yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah, right. So you've actually gone and created a bunch of offensive tools just for AWS stuff, haven't you? And you got them there on GitHub.
Exactly. So I used to run detection for Atlassian, and we run a whole bunch of our cloud infrastructure on AWS. So I really wanted to write some robust detection and find out what could be done. So as you do, as a kind of pen tester back in the day, you write all the offensive tools so you can detect all the offensive techniques. So I've got everything on available on GitHub for people to play with, and we can do all sorts of fun things with AWS using those tools.
Yeah, like walk us through them. Like what?
So you take your whole end-to-end process, everything from reconnaissance, so identifying all sorts of resources. So it turns out that pretty much every resource in AWS you can somehow enumerate. So there's tools to do that. Going through to compromise, to elevation once you've got an access key, and then things like backdooring and then maintaining persistence. You can think of AWS as a giant computer with lots of different services and APIs. And so maintaining persistence can be done in like an infinite number of ways. And I've gone and done it in a few fun ways. One of the demos I like to give, for example, is a function that reacts to your users being deleted by creating two more users. So if you backdoor a single API access key and an administrator finds it, as soon as they delete it, this function will just react to that event and just create two more. And
does that work? How do you actually get into a position where you can get it to do that? Like you say, it's a function. Where does that function run?
So this is one of those things. Is AWS has a service called Lambda, which is they call serverless functions. So you just give it a bit of Python code, and in the background, it runs the code for you magically on some instance that you don't have to manage or anything like that. And those Lambda functions react to events that happen in AWS. In this case, the event is delete a user access key, and the function creates two new ones.
So this is like some hidden instance that isn't one of your instances, so it's completely out of the control of the host OSs that you're running. This is just some weird Amazon buried computational thing that you can use on your account. Sounds like a great idea.
Well, it is. It actually makes a lot of things really easy. You can write a really powerful API super quick and it's super trivial, but you can also abuse it for things like persistence.
Yeah, I mean, I can see where it'd be really, really useful for management and stuff, but like, what's the transparency like? How obvious is it going to be that something funny's going on when someone like you has been rigging the Python scripts there?
Yeah, so that depends on the quality of your logging, right? And if you haven't turned it on, you're pretty much screwed. But if you have turned it on, even then you might not notice it because the first X million number of Lambda executions are free. So you might never like even notice that these things are executing in the background.
So that's one persistence trick. What's another one?
You can do lots of different things. You can modify server startup scripts without anyone knowing. You can proxy APIs. There's the concept of trust relationships that I really would like to explore. And that is the way that third-party integrations talk to Amazon accounts is they create a trust relationship and assume a role into the account. And basically, you can just add permissions for yourself to assume a role in someone else's account.
Come again?
It's just a way of, instead of using an access key, you just say, hey, someone else can go and access my account. And this is the user that can go do it. Except the user isn't in your account, it's somewhere else.
So can you try to give us an example, like a hypothetical scenario?
Okay, so a good example is, let's say you use an integration for cost management or monitoring, right? You have to give that integration access to your account. And the old school way of doing it is you just go give them an access key, right? Like an API token that they use. And then they just use that to programmatically access your account. But the new school way of doing it is you just create this magical permission called a trust relationship that says the vendor's account can access yours. And magically they can. They can assume a role into your account. So if you've gained access to someone's accounts, you can just backdoor every single role and trust relationship that they already have, as well as creating new ones for yourself to use later on. And I've got a tool in my repo that does exactly that. The reality is that those suppliers are a really interesting vector to getting into AWS accounts. So if you take the recent Datadog breach incident last year, Datadog says, for example, you need to give them a certain set of permissions. And to make all their stuff work, those permissions are pretty broad. Now, if you own Datadog as an example, you've then got access to all the accounts to which they have integrations. And then you can do fun. Yeah. So it's just a supply chain attack, a different kind of supply chain attack, except it exists in AWS.
It's a little bit like some of the trust problems that pop up with OAuth and in consumer accounts, only this affects entire enterprises and their entire, magical cloud presence.
Yeah, it is. Except there's lots and lots of accounts that give permissions to a single provider. And if you compromise that provider, you've then got access to all of those accounts.
Okay, that's fun. So we've covered persistence, you've got some enumeration stuff on there. Anything else that's worth chatting about?
There's a whole bunch. I mean, I found some cool tricks to, if you've got a certain set of permissions, to basically get remote code execution on any EC2 instance. And that's by design. It's by reading some of those important text boxes that I talked about earlier. There's a whole slew of things that you can do to hack AWS accounts.
Yeah, okay. That's all fun stuff. Now, I'll drop a link into this week's show notes so that people can actually go check all of that stuff out. But you're actually about to release something new that sounds pretty cool. It seems a little bit sort of Canary Tokens inspired, but it's for AWS access tokens.
Yeah, look, I'm sure Haroon would love this stuff. So every hacker wants AWS API keys, right? Because they're effectively the keys to the kingdom. They're the golden credential these days. So you can create fake ones that you can spread around the place, and then attackers will try and potentially tell you that they're being compromised. And we've actually done this in the past and found third-party SaaS providers that have been compromised just by spreading our fake tokens around the place.
So you put them into some data that's held by a third party, and then all of a sudden you're noticing attempted access against those keys, and you're like, well, obviously they've been owned.
Yeah, exactly. And so we've made a tool, or when we're going to release in the next couple of weeks, an open source tool that takes a free, a new AWS account, and just you press the button and it spins up all the infrastructure you need to run these things at scale. So it's easy to run, to create one fake token. But when you're talking about tens of thousands for, say, all of your servers or all of your workstations, that's really hard to do and to manage. So we've just made it so you can click the button and all the stuff is spun up for you. Everything's in a fresh account. It backs up, restores, distributes all the keys, and all the policies and encryption and everything else is set up for you so you don't have to deal with it all.
So where would you actually sprinkle these honey tokens around? I mean, what sort of documents would attackers expect to find access keys in?
So this is the fun thing. You can put them anywhere because they're so valuable. So you can put them in generic AWS credentials file where they'd expect to be found, or you can put them in your database, all your S3 buckets. You can put them in workstations or the startup scripts on all your virtual servers. It's basically up to your imagination. The thing is, an attacker can't know whether it's a honey token until they actually try it. And they have to try it on a global API that's fully logged.
Yeah, right. And so because the thing that you've built, you're spinning it up in its own AWS account, and I'm presuming it turns on all of the logging and everything, you're going to know pretty quick smart, right? And I believe you've set up phone alerts, email, you got Jira coming as well.
Yep. Email, PagerDuty, and Jira are going to be available out of the box. Yeah. So you just have to give it an API key and it's done.
And that's a free thing.
Free and open source.
Yeah, and is this an Atlassian thing? I mean, or, you know, I mean, is this something you're using internally? Obviously, it would be, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the idea is build it for our use internal, but then give it to everyone else so that they can use it as well.
Hippie, you should be out there trying to raise fat VC, Daniel. Come on, what are you doing?
I don't think that's my way.
Do you get the feeling, because I'd imagine nowadays in your job, you'd get a fair bit of contact with consultants and pen testers and whatnot. Do you feel like they're adequately on top of this?
No, I don't think so. Not yet. This, like, most consultants that I've heard about are still doing it the kind of the old fashioned ways. How do you secure a web server, or how do you secure a 3-tier architecture? They're not thinking about how AWS works natively. And I think that's just a result of not having the experience yet in these big, like, AWS infrastructures. Can I just add one thing? I know throughout this interview it sounds like I'm ragging on AWS, but I'm really not. We use AWS for everything, and we love it, and I love it. It's just you've really got to be on top of it to use it right.
All right. Well, sage advice. Daniel Jalak, thank you very much for joining us on the show to walk us through some of the tools you've created for AWS, fun and profit.
Thanks for having me. It's been too long.
That was Daniel Jalak there of Atlassian. And after that interview, he went to great pains to clarify what he was talking about in regards to the Datadog breach. He says the attackers in that case didn't actually use the trust relationships to exploit Datadog's customers, but they could have, and that's what he was getting at. I've linked through to his GitHub repo in this week's show notes, so do go and check that out. And I'll be sure to mention the new stuff when it comes out as well. He'll get in touch with me and I'll let you all know. Okay, this week's show is brought to you by Veracode. That is this week's sponsor. Veracode, of course, makes code scanners that security teams and developers can use to make more secure software. If you ask any code scanning company, they'll tell you the same thing. Security scans have well and truly moved left into the workflow. They've moved much earlier into the workflow of developers at a bunch of organizations. I guess these sorts of tools have become the equivalent of spell checking your work. And furthermore, the tighter integration between developers and security staff means both sides need to know more about each other's disciplines, and that is actually happening. Eventually, this will lead to less friction between development and security, but we're not there yet. Misunderstandings abound. Veracode's Director of Developer Engagement, Peter Chesner, joined the show this week to talk through how developers can become better security people and how security people can become better developers. Here he is.
Today, you have tooling that's available that can give you almost instantaneous feedback on the code you've just written in a very similar fashion to, you know, I use this metaphor all the time. If I'm a C++ developer and I move to Java, the thing that's going to get me at first is the syntax change. And I'm going to learn to write compilable code by doing the same thing that developers always do. I save and compile all the time. If you add security into that as a byproduct of that compilation, then they're getting that security feedback at the same time and building that understanding as they go. So it's a difference in the way the tools have matured that allows them to get closer to the time where they actually wrote the defect.
It kind of reminds me of when spell checkers came out. Spell checkers first became a thing. And the thinking was, among my parents' generation, oh, these spell checker things are terrible because kids these days won't need to know how to spell. But it had the opposite effect, because every time you spelled something wrong, you wound up with a very annoying little squiggly red line under the word. I mean, it's the same sort of effect in the developer world, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And that's really the basis of where these tools have gone over the past, 5 years, of moving them as far left as they can get, right in the IDE as they're writing the code.
Yeah. So what do you think are the biggest misconceptions that security people have of development and development people have of security? Let's start with the security people, because, there are AppSec managers out there who don't come from a development background. They come from a security background. What do they not get? Like, what are the biggest clangers that you can think of?
So they don't understand how development works. One of the things that I preach, so I do a lot of talking at conferences, security conferences, as well as development conferences. And it's the understanding their job. So, reading things like the Phoenix Project or the DevOps Handbook, actually going in and writing code, there's nothing that's going to give them an understanding for what's happening than if they write some security code that can then be leveraged by other teams. So if you really want to understand their world, get in there and write them some cleansing functions. Get in there and write them something that will do encoding. And then understand how hard that is to get right, not only to get it to compile, but to get it to work properly and build up automated testing around that. So a lot of times, people that have dabbled in that, and most people in an AppSec background have done some coding in some language, so fine, apply that now.
Yeah, but I mean, usually when a security person's written their own code, it's some bodgy thing they've hacked together to, you know, generate some graphs or, you know, like it's not real developer work, is it? You know, and I've seen people get a little bit smug, like, oh, I've coded stuff. And it's like, well, you've done something simple that only required one person. You weren't working as a team within some sort of structure. Yep. So what you're saying is get involved, roll up your sleeves, show us how it's done then, wise ass.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is start to attend some of the ceremonies. You know, Agile has the concept of having chickens in the meeting to listen and watch. So why aren't they learning and working with each other to understand the kind of pressures that they're under, the kind of timeframes that they work in, the amount of work that they push through on a daily basis? They're not sitting around doing nothing. And it's not that they don't care about security. It's just they don't understand security yet.
Mm. So let's switch to the other side. What are the biggest misconceptions that you feel, you know, some developers have about the AppSec managers and AppSec teams?
So again, it's largely about they don't understand my job. On both sides of that, it feels like it's a number one priority is I don't understand their job. They're just a function, not a person. You know, so part of this is breaking down that barrier by actually, you know, being in meetings together or having lunch together or something like that. The other part is, you know, this whole concept of I'm the no man. When they bring the application to you, you say no because all of these reasons. You know, you do your pen test or your other testing, it goes into this black hole and you come back with all these reasons that I can't ship. Why aren't you helping me ship my product? So a lot of security teams that are working well in their AppSec teams are actually working to advise and not be the ones that say no. In fact, the really high-performing AppSec teams actually translate and give the responsibility of accepting security vulnerabilities in cases of mitigations directly to the development managers to say, I am here to advise you and help you understand what you are about to accept, but it's on you when you accept this risk if the company is breached because of it.
See, the security person deep within me is just twitching at that, just thinking that's an awesome way to compile, you know, to accumulate a whole bunch of technical debt because people will accept anything.
Well, again, it needs to be – it's responsibility for that action, right? They don't just get the power. They get the responsibility of that.
They get the risk to their KPIs as well, right?
Well, their career. So it won't be the CISO that gets fired. It's the AppSec, it's the development manager that accepted the mitigation without asking the right questions of their developers. Because, you know, from the same concept, the developers will try to get anything as a false positive. Like, oh, well, all of these results are false positives. It can never happen. You know, it takes a long time to walk them through that process to help them understand them in the first place.
It's interesting, though, I think that I asked you about misconceptions about security teams and you told me how they were perceived. And I was just thinking, if I was a developer, I can't imagine perceiving them terribly differently. Do you know what I mean? So, like, I can understand those seem like reasonable perceptions. If I'm a developer, I am looking at security and I'm thinking you are the people who tell me that I can't play with my friends, that I can't, you know, do what I want to do. That makes a lot of sense. But where are the misconceptions? Because, you know, I think we had a really clear answer to that on the security side. The misconception is that, you know, development is really easy and secure development is really easy. What's the misconception, though, on the developer side? What have they got wrong? Where is the misunderstanding?
So I think that they think that these things are all BS. You know, these aren't real vulnerabilities. These aren't things that can happen. They don't understand, you know, the concept of a SQL injection. Well, you know, what could that cause? And how could that hurt me or my application? Why am I responsible for this? They don't get, you know, how dangerous some of this stuff is, not only to their application, but to their company.
So that's the misconception is that they think that it's a sort of somewhat unnecessary function that's being served by this AppSec team.
Yeah, you're grading me too hard.
Yeah, right.
It'll be fine. Don't worry about it.
But I guess, look, this switch to DevOps, right? You've got accelerating release cycles, you know, and you've got, you know, pure, real, actual DevOps. That's got to be combating this, right? That's got to be bringing people closer together. I mean, is it kumbaya time yet, or is it like we're still a little way off?
We're still a little ways off. I think, you know, security team is used to white knuckling the releases. They're used to those long time frames in the world of waterfall. The teams that are moving to agile, they're starting to loosen their grip a little bit. DevOps is just like way beyond their capabilities. They're, you know, they've got their hands gripped around that release. They don't understand how to move faster. Part of this is, you know, right-sizing the testing. So you can't pen test everything. And that's not to say that pen testing is not an important aspect of releasing software. You just need to decide what are the places where I have to pen test versus trusting technology that's been written to do static analysis and dynamic analysis and composition analysis to look at, you know, known open source vulnerabilities. Those tools can find things faster and cheaper than any human possibly could. So how do you apply your very limited resources in a way that gives you great effect inside of the company? So it's thinking about things like, did it touch encryption? Does it touch my authorization or my authentication functions? Those are things I want to pen test, and everything else can go, you know, go through those automated tools.
See, what I like about this trend for companies like yourselves, like all of your competitors, in fact, you know, these developer tools, developer security tools, as all the companies who make them like to say, they've moved to the left. They've become something that happens a lot earlier in the development phase. What I like about this, if I'm an AppSec, on the AppSec side and I'm the security manager, is that if I mandate that you have to use these tools, something like Veracode, any of the good code scanners are not going to let the really serious, simple vulnerabilities through. They're just not. And what I get if I insist that a developer team uses this is I shift the accountability straight onto them in a way that is provable. Because if a problem right. pops up later, I can go over to that developer's workstation and say, show me that code. You know, I can look at that code on the screen, then I can hit the little scan button and I can say, oh, look at all these warnings. Why didn't you do anything about it then? Is that something that's that is a bit of a selling point for security people? Because I would have thought it would be, in that you get that, you get that C moment, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, this is not dissimilar to when people started to move to Agile and you got people writing and running unit tests. You know, people talked about unit tests in those days, but they didn't really do them very often. And often you would have that case where the developer would change one line of code and is like, well, this couldn't affect anything. And then they check it in and the build's broken or it fails the unit tests or, you know, something like that, where it's like, no, you needed to run them before you checked in. Now you've got the rubber chicken hanging over your desk. The same thing is occurring with security now, where we're giving them the right tooling that to give them the quality results in the right amount of time such that they know before they check in. You can take the test before you check in, and this becomes part of their definition of done for their Agile and DevOps teams.
But that's kind of my point, is you can prove that they didn't. You can prove that they didn't run the tooling, right? And that seems pretty valuable, because if I'm a developer at that point, I'm like, I should probably fix that, you know, SQL injection bug, because if I don't and it gets found later, they will know that I ignored my scanner.
Well, the key is they have to run the tests. So, you know, the point I was trying to make is some people, they wouldn't run their unit tests before check-in. Sometimes they don't run their security tests. So it's not that necessarily they ignored it, it's just they didn't do it at all. And you're right. So the way I talk about this is the stuff that happens pre-check-in is your preventative scanning, and the stuff that happens afterwards is your assurance scanning. It proves that everyone's doing the right things earlier in the process before check-in, and you can actually start talking about, you know, you move from the model of fixing what we find, which is that very, you know, I'm reacting to the scanners, to I've run the scanners beforehand and everything that comes through should be clean. So you can expect a green pipeline all the time.
Yeah. All right. Well, Peter Chestner, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about all of this. It is an interesting old experience for me, having been around InfoSec for a long time, watching developers just sort of pile into the industry. It's a fantastic thing that I was a bit skeptical about it ever happening, but it is wonderful. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Veracode's Peter Chestner there. And if you're a developer who's new to security, and you know, there are a bunch of you listening, I do know that, do go check out Veracode's stuff. Veracode was founded by some really, really smart people, and they're certainly one of the biggest names in this field. So, I mean, you just can't look at these types of scanners without having Vericode on your list. You can find them at vericode.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. But until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.